machine gun at his side. He pushed the safety off. Then he went to sleep. When he woke, it was dark. He swung his legs over the edge of the bed and sat listening. He rose and walked to the window and pulled the curtain back slightly and looked out. Deep shadows, silence, nothing. He got dressed and put the gun under the mattress with the safety still off and smoothed down the dust skirt and sat on the bed and picked up the phone and called a cab. He had to pay the driver an extra $10 to take him across the bridge to Ciudad Acuña. He walked the streets, looking into the shop windows. The evening was soft and warm, and in the little Alameda, grackles were settling in the trees and calling to one another. He went into a boot shop and looked at the exotics, crocodile and ostrich and elephant, but the quality of the boots was nothing like the Larry Mahan's that he wore. He went into a pharmacia and bought a tin of bandages and sat in the park and patched his raw feet. His socks were already bloody. At the corner, a cab driver asked him if he wanted to go see the girls, and Moss held up his hand for him to see the ring he wore and kept on walking. He ate in a restaurant with white tablecloths and waiters in white jackets. He ordered a glass of red wine and a porterhouse steak. It was early and the restaurant was empty, save for him. He sipped the wine, and when the steak came, he cut into it and chewed slowly and thought about his life. He got back to the motel a little after 10 and sat in the cab with the motor running while he counted out money for the fare. He handed the bills across the seat, and he started to get out, but he didn't. He sat there with his hand on the door handle. "Drive me around to the other side," he said. The driver put the shifter in gear. "What room?" he said. "Just drive me around. I want to see if somebody's here." They drove slowly past his room. There was a gap in the curtains. He was pretty sure he hadn't left there. Hard to tell. Not that hard. The cab tolled slowly past. No cars in the lot that hadn't been there. "Keep going," he said. The driver looked at him in the mirror. "Keep going," said Moss. "Don't stop."
"I don't want to get in some kind of a jackpot here, buddy. Just keep going." "Why don't I let you out here, and we won't argue about it? I want you to take me to another motel. Let's just call it square."
Moss leaned forward and held a $100 bill across the seat. "You're already in a jackpot," he said. "I'm trying to get you out of it. Now take me to a motel." The driver took the bill and tucked it into his shirt pocket and turned out of the lot and into the street. He spent the night at the Ramada Inn out on the highway, and in the morning he went down and ate breakfast in the dining room and read the paper. Then he just sat there. They wouldn't be in the room when the maids came to clean it. Checkout time is 11 o'clock. They could have found the money and left. Except, of course, that there were probably at least two parties looking for him, and whichever one this was, it wasn't the other, and the other wasn't going away either. By the time he got up, he knew that he was probably going to have to kill somebody. He just didn't know who it was. He took a cab and went into town and went into a sporting goods store and bought a 12-gauge Winchester pump gun and a box of double-aught buckshot shells. The box of shells contained almost exactly the firepower of a Claymore mine. He had them wrap the gun, and he left with it under his arm and walked up Pecan Street to a hardware store. There he bought a hacksaw and a flat mill file and some miscellaneous items, a pair of pliers and a pair of side cutters, a screwdriver, flashlight, a roll of duct tape. He stood on the sidewalk with his purchases. Then he turned and walked back down the street. In the sporting goods store again, he asked the same clerk if he had any aluminum tent poles. He tried to explain that he didn't care what kind of tent it was. He just needed the poles. The clerk studied him.
"Whatever kind of tent it is," he said, "we'd still have to special order poles for it. You need to get the manufacturer and the model number." "You sell tents, right?" "We got three different models. Which one has got the most poles in it?" "Well, I guess that would be our 10-foot wall tent. You can stand up in it." "Well, some people could stand up in it. It's got a 6-foot clearance at the ridge." Let me have one.
Yes, sir.
He brought the tent from the stockroom and laid it on the counter. It came in an orange nylon bag. Moss laid the shotgun and the bag of hardware on the counter and untied the strings and pulled the tent from the bag together with the poles and cords.
It's all there, the clerk said. What do I owe you?
It's $179 plus tax.
He laid two of the $100 bills on the counter. The tent poles were in a separate bag, and he pulled this out and put it with his other things. The clerk gave him his change and the receipt, and Moss gathered up the shotgun and his hardware purchases together with the tent poles and thanked him and turned and left.
What about the tent? The clerk called.
In the room, he unwrapped the shotgun and wedged it in an open drawer and held it and sawed the barrel off just in front of the magazine. He squared up the cut with the file and smoothed it and wiped out the muzzle of the barrel with a damp face cloth and set it aside. Then he sawed off the stock in a line that left it with a pistol grip and sat on the bed and dressed the grip smooth with the file. When he had it the way he wanted it, he slid the forearm back and slid it forward again and let the hammer down with his thumb and turned it sideways and looked at it. It looked pretty good. He turned it over and opened the box of shells and fed the heavy waxed loads into the magazine one by one. He jacked the slide back and chambered a shell and lowered the hammer and then put one more round in the magazine and laid the gun across his lap. It was less than 2 feet long. He called the Trail Motel and told the woman to hold his room for him. Then he shoved the gun and the shells and the tools under the mattress and went out again. He went to Walmart and bought some clothes and a small nylon zipper bag to put them in, a pair of jeans and a couple of shirts and some socks. In the afternoon, he went for a long walk out along the lake, taking the cut-off gun barrel and the stock with him in the bag. He slung the barrel out into the water as far as he could throw it, and he buried the stock under a ledge of shale. There were deer moving away through the desert scrub. He heard them snort, and he could see them where they came out on the ridge 100 yards away to stand looking back at him. He sat on a gravel beach with the empty bag folded in his lap and watched the sunset, watched the land turn blue and cold. An osprey went down the lake. Then there was just the darkness. Part 4.
I was sheriff of this county when I was 25. Hard to believe. My father was not a lawman. Jack was my grandfather, and me and him was sheriff at the same time, him in Plano and me here. I think he was pretty proud of that. I know I was. I was just back from the war. I had some medals and stuff, and of course people had got wind of that. I campaigned pretty hard. You had to. I tried to be fair. Jack used to say that any time you're throwing dirt, you're losing ground. But I think mostly it just wasn't in him, to speak ill of anybody. And I never did mind being like him. Me and my wife has been married 31 years, no children. We lost a girl, but I won't talk about that. I served 2 terms, and then we moved to Denton, Texas. Jack used to say that being sheriff was one of the best jobs you could have, and being an ex-sheriff, one of the worst. Maybe lots of things is like that. We stayed gone and stayed gone. I done different things, was a detective on the railroad for a while. By that time, my wife wasn't all that sure about us coming back here, about me running. But she seen I wanted to, so that's what we done. She's a better person than me, which I will admit to anybody that cares to listen. Not that that's saying a whole lot. She's a better person than anybody I know, period. People think they know what they want, but they generally don't. Sometimes if they're lucky, they'll get it anyways. Me? I was always lucky. My whole life. I wouldn't be here otherwise, scrapes I've been in. But the day I seen her come out of Kerr's Mercantile and cross the street and she passed me and I tipped my hat to her and got just almost a smile back, that was the luckiest. People complain about the bad things that happen to them, that they don't deserve, but they seldom mention the good. About what they done to deserve them things. I don't recall that I ever give the good Lord all that much cause to smile on me, but he did.
When Bell walked into the cafe on Tuesday morning, it was just daylight. He got his paper and went to his table in the corner. The men he passed at the big table nodded to him and said, "Sheriff." The waitress brought him his coffee and went back to the kitchen and ordered his eggs. He sat stirring the coffee with his spoon, although there was nothing to stir since he drank it black. The Haskins boy's picture was on the front page of the Austin paper. Bell read, shaking his head. His wife was 20 years old.
"You know what you could do for her? Not a damn thing." Lamar had never lost a man in 20-some-odd years. This is what he would remember. This is what he'd be remembered for.
She came with his eggs, and he folded the paper and laid it by. He took Wendell with him, and they drove down to the desert air and stood at the door while Wendell knocked.
"Look at the lock," Bell said.
Wendell drew his pistol and opened the door.
"Sheriff's Department," he called.
"There ain't nobody here."
"No reason not to be careful."
"That's right, no reason in the world."
They walked in and stood. Wendell would have holstered his pistol, but Bell stopped him.
"Let's just keep to that careful routine," he said.
"Yes, sir."
He walked over and picked up a small brass slug off the carpet and held it up.
"What's that?"
said Wendell.
"Cylinder out of the lock."
Bell passed his hand over the plywood of the room divider.
"Here's where it hit at," he said.
He balanced the piece of brass in his palm and looked toward the door.
"You could weigh this thing and measure the distance and the drop and calculate the speed."
"I expect you could."
"Pretty good speed."
"Yes, sir. Pretty good speed."
They walked through the rooms.
"What do you think, Sheriff?"
"I believe they've done lit a shuck."
"I do, too."
"Kindly in a hurry about it, too."
"Yep."
He walked into the kitchen and opened the refrigerator and looked in and shut it again. He looked in the freezer.
"So when was he here, Sheriff?"
"Hard to say. We might have just missed him."
"You think this boy's got any notion of the sorts of sons of bitches that are hunting him?"
"I don't know. He ought to. He's seen the same things I seen, and it made an impression on me."
"They're in a world of trouble, ain't they?"
"Yes, they are."
Bell walked back into the living room. He sat on the sofa. Wendell stood in the doorway. He was still holding the revolver in his hand.
"What are you thinking?"
he said. Bell shook his head. He didn't look up. By Wednesday, half the state of Texas was on its way to Sanderson. Bell sat at his table in the cafe and read the news. He lowered the paper and looked up. A man about 30 years old that he'd never seen before was standing there. He introduced himself as a reporter for the San Antonio Light.
"What's this all about, Sheriff?" he said.
"It appears to be a hunting accident."
"Hunting accident?"
"Yes, sir."
"How could it be a hunting accident? You're pulling my leg."
"Let me ask you something."
"All right."
"Last year, 19 felony charges were filed in the Terrell County Court. How many of those would you say were not drug-related?"
"I don't know."
"2. In the meantime, I got a county the size of Delaware that is full of people who need my help. What do you think about that?"
"I don't know."
"I don't either. Now, I just need to eat my breakfast here. I got kindly a full day ahead."
He and Torbert drove out in Torbert's four-wheel drive truck. All was as they'd left it. They parked a ways from Moss's truck and waited.
"It's 10, Torbert said.
"What?"
"It's 10. Deceased. We forgot about old Wyrick. It's 10.
Bell nodded.
"That we know about," he said.
"Yes, sir. That we know about."
The helicopter arrived and circled and set down in a whirl of dust out on the Bajada. Nobody got out. They were waiting for the dust to blow away. Bell and Torbert watched the rotor winding down. The DEA agent's name was McIntyre. Bell knew him slightly and liked him about well enough to nod to. He got out with a clipboard in his hand and walked toward them. He was dressed in boots and a hat and a Carhartt canvas jacket, and he looked all right until he opened his mouth.
"Sheriff Bell," he said.
"Agent McIntyre."
"What vehicle is this?"
"It's a 72 Ford pickup."
McIntyre stood looking out down the Bajada. He tapped the clipboard against his leg. He looked at Bell.
"I'm happy to know that," he said. "White in color."
"I'd say white, yes."
"Could use a set of tires." He went over and walked around the truck. He wrote on his clipboard. He looked inside. He folded the seat forward and looked in the back.
"Who cut the tires?"
Bell was standing with his hands in his back pockets. He leaned and spat.
"Deputy Hayes here believes it was done by a rival party."
"Rival party?"
"Yes, sir."
"I thought these vehicles were all shot up."
"They are."
"But not this one."
"Not this one."
McIntyre looked toward the chopper, and he looked down the Bajada toward the other vehicles.
"Can I get a ride down there with you?"
"Sure you can."
They walked toward Torbert's truck. The agent looked at Bell, and he tapped the clipboard against his leg.
"You don't intend to make this easy, do you?"
"Oh, McIntyre, I'm just messing with you."
They walked around in the Bajada, looking at the shot-up trucks. McIntyre held a kerchief to his nose. The bodies were bloated in their clothes.
"This is about the damnedest thing I ever saw," he said.
He stood making notes on his clipboard. He paced distances and made a rough sketch of the scene, and he copied out the numbers off the license plates.
"Were there no guns here?" he said.
"Not as many as there should have been. We got two pieces in evidence."
"How long you think they've been dead?"
4 or 5 days."
"Somebody must have got away."
Bell nodded.
"There's another body about a mile north of here."
"There's heroin spilled in the back of that Bronco."
"Yep."
"Mexican black tar."
Bell looked at Torbert. Torbert leaned and spat.
"If the heroin is missing and the money is missing, then my guess is that somebody is missing."
"I'd say that's a reasonable guess."
McIntyre continued writing.
"Don't worry," he said. "I know you didn't get it."
"I ain't worried."
McIntyre adjusted his hat and stood looking at the trucks.
"Are the Rangers coming out here?"
"Rangers are coming. Or one is. DPS drug unit."
"I've got 380s, 45s, 9mm Parabellum, 12-gauge, and a 38 Special. Did you find anything else?"
"I think that was it."
McIntyre nodded.
"I guess the people waiting for their dope have probably figured out by now that it's not coming. What about the Border Patrol?"
"Everybody's coming, as far as I know. We expect it to get right lively. Might could be a bigger draw than the flood back in 65.
"Yeah."
"What we need is to get these bodies out of here."
McIntyre tapped the clipboard against his leg.
"Ain't that the truth," he said. 9mm Parabellum," said Torbert.
Bell nodded.
"You need to put that in your files."
Chigurh picked up the signal from the transponder coming across the high span of the Devil's River Bridge, just west of Del Rio. It was near midnight and no cars on the highway. He reached over into the passenger seat and turned the dial slowly forward and then back, listening. The headlights picked up some kind of a large bird sitting on the aluminum bridge rail up ahead, and Chigurh pushed the button to let the window down, cool air coming in off the lake. He took the pistol from beside the box and cocked and leveled it out the window, resting the barrel on the rearview mirror. The pistol had been fitted with a silencer sweated onto the end of the barrel. The silencer was made out of brass map gas burners, fitted into a hairspray can, and the whole thing stuffed with fiberglass roofing insulation and painted flat black. He fired just as the bird crouched and spread its wings. It flared wildly in the lights, very white, turning and lifting away into the darkness. The shot had hit the rail and caromed off into the night, and the rail hummed dully in the slipstream and ceased. Sugar laid the pistol in the seat and put the window back up again. Moss paid the driver and stepped out into the lights in front of the motel office and slung the bag over his shoulder and shut the cab door and turned and went in. The woman was already behind the counter. He set the bag in the floor and leaned on the counter. She looked a little flustered.
"Hi," she said. "You fixin' to stay a while?"
"I need another room."
"You want to change rooms, or you want another one besides one you've got?"
"I want to keep the one I got and get another one."
"All right."
"Have you got a map of the motel?" She looked under the counter.
"There used to be a sort of a one. Wait a minute. I think this is it."
She laid an old brochure on the counter. It showed a car from the 50s parked in front. He unfolded it and flattened it out and studied it.
"What about 142?
"You can have one next to yours if you want it. 120 ain't took."
"That's all right. What about 142?
She reached and got the key off the board behind her.
"You'll owe for 2 nights, she said.
He paid and picked up the bag and walked out and turned down the walkway at the rear of the motel. She leaned over the counter, watching him go. In the room, he sat on the bed with the map spread out. He got up and went into the bathroom and stood in the tub with his ear to the wall. A TV was playing somewhere. He went back and sat and unzipped the bag and took out the shotgun and laid it to one side and then emptied the bag out onto the bed. He took the screwdriver and got the chair from the desk and stood on it and unscrewed the air duct grill and stepped down and laid it dust side up on the cheap chenille bedspread. Then he climbed up and put his ear to the duct. He listened. He stood down and got the flashlight and climbed back up again. There was a junction in the ductwork about 10 feet down the shaft, and he could see the end of the bag sticking out. He turned off the light and stood listening. He tried listening with his eyes shut. He climbed down and got the shotgun and went to the door and turned off the light at the switch there and stood in the dark looking out through the curtain at the courtyard. Then went back and laid the shotgun on the bed and turned on the flashlight. He untied the little nylon bag and slid the poles out. They were lightweight aluminum tubes, 3 feet long, and he assembled 3 of them and taped the joints with duct tape so that they wouldn't pull apart. He went to the closet and came back with 3 wire hangers and sat on the bed and cut the hooks off with the side cutters and wrapped them into 1 hook with a tape. Then he taped them to the end of the pole and stood up and slid the pole down the ductwork. He turned the flashlight off and pitched it onto the bed and went back to the window and looked out. Drone of a truck passing out on the highway. He waited till it was gone. A cat that was crossing the courtyard stopped, then it went on again. He stood on the chair with a flashlight in his hand. He turned on the light and laid the lens up close against the galvanized metal wall of the duct so as to mute the beam, and ran the hook down past the bag and turned it and brought it back. The hook caught and turned the bag slightly and then slipped free again. After a few tries, he managed to get it caught in one of the straps, and he towed it silently up the duct, hand over hand, through the dust, until he could let go the pole and reach the bag. He climbed down and sat on the bed and wiped the dust from the case and unfastened the latch and the straps and opened it and looked at the packets of bills. He took one of them from the case and riffled it. Then he fitted it back and undid the length of cord he'd tied to the strap and turned off the flashlight and sat listening. He stood and reached up and shoved the poles down the duct, and then he put back the grid and gathered up his tools. He laid the key on the desk and put the shotgun and the tools in the bag and took it and the case and walked out the door, leaving everything just as it was. Sugar drove slowly along the row of motel rooms with the window down and the receiver in his lap. He turned at the end of the lot and came back. He slowed to a stop and put the ram charger in reverse and backed slightly down the blacktop and stopped again. Finally, he drove around to the office and parked and went in. The clock on the motel office wall said 12:42. The television set was on, and the woman looked like she'd been asleep.
"Yes, sir," she said. "Can I help you?"
He left the office with the key in his shirt pocket and got into the ram charger and drove around to the side of the building and parked and got out and walked down to the room, carrying the bag with the receiver and the guns in it. In the room, he dropped the bag onto the bed and pulled off his boots and came back out with the receiver and the battery pack and the shotgun from the truck. The shotgun was a 12-gauge Remington automatic with a plastic military stock and a Parkerized finish. It was fitted with a shop-made silencer, fully a foot long and big around as a beer can. He walked down the Ramada in his sock feet past the rooms, listening to the signal. He came back to the room and stood in the open door under the dead white light from the parking lot lamp. He walked into the bathroom and turned the light on there. He took the measure of the room and looked to see where everything was. He measured where the light switches were. Then he stood in the room, taking it all in once again. He sat and pulled on his boots and got the air tank and slung it across his shoulder and caught up the cattle gun where it swung from the rubber air hose and walked out and down to the room. He stood listening at the door. Then he punched out the lock cylinder with the air gun and kicked open the door. A Mexican in a green guayabera had sat up on the bed and was reaching for a small machine gun beside him. Sugar shot him three times so fast it sounded like one long gunshot and left most of the upper part of him spread across the headboard and the wall behind it. The shotgun made a strange, deep, chugging sound, like someone coughing into a barrel. He snapped on the light and stepped out of the doorway and stood with his back to the outside wall. He looked in again, quickly. The bathroom door had been shut. Now it was open. He stepped into the room and fired two loads through the standing door and another through the wall and stepped out again. Down toward the end of the building, a light had come on. Sugar waited. Then he looked into the room once more. The door was blown into shredded plywood, hanging off the hinges, and a thin stream of blood had started across the pink bathroom tiles. He stepped into the doorway and fired two more rounds through the bathroom wall, and then walked in with the shotgun leveled at his waist. The man was lying, slumped against the tub, holding an AK-47. He was shot in the chest and the neck, and he was bleeding heavily.
"No me mate," he wheezed. "No me mate."
Sugar stepped back to avoid the spray of ceramic chips off the tub and shot him in the face. He walked out and stood on the sidewalk. No one there. He went back in and searched the room. He looked in the closet and he looked under the bed and he pulled all the drawers out onto the floor. He looked in the bathroom. Moss's H&K machine pistol was lying on the sink. He left it there. He wiped his feet back and forth on the carpet to get the blood off the soles of his boots, and he stood looking at the room. Then his eye fell on the air duct. He took the lamp from beside the bed and jerked the cord free and climbed up on the dresser and stove in the grate with the metal lamp base and pulled it loose and looked in. He could see the drag marks in the dust. He climbed down and stood there. He'd got blood and matter on his shirt from off the wall, and he took the shirt off and went back into the bathroom and washed himself and dried with one of the bath towels. Then he wet the towel and wiped off his boots and folded the towel again and wiped down the legs of his jeans. He picked up the shotgun and came back into the room naked to the waist, the shirt balled in one hand. He wiped his boot soles on the carpet again and looked around the room a last time and left. When Bell walked into the office, Torbert looked up from his desk and then rose and came over and laid a paper down in front of him.
"Is this it?" Bell said.
"Yes, sir."
Bell leaned back in his chair to read, tapping his lower lip slowly with his forefinger. After a while, he put the report down. He didn't look at Torbert.
I know what happened here, he said.
All right.
Have you ever been to a slaughterhouse?
Yes, sir. I believe so.
You'd know it if you had.
I think I went once when I was a kid.
Funny place to take a kid.
I think I went my own self, snuck in.
How'd they kill the beef?
They had a knocker straddled the chute, and they'd let the beeves through one at a time, and he'd knock 'em in the head with a maul. He'd done that all day.
That sounds about right. Well, they don't do it that way no more. They use an air-powered gun that shoots a steel bolt out of it. Just shoots it out about so far. They put that thing between the beef's eyes and pull the trigger, and down she goes. It's that quick.
Torbert was standing at the corner of Bell's desk. He waited a minute for the sheriff to continue, but the sheriff didn't continue. Torbert stood there. Then he looked away.
I wish you hadn't have even told me, he said.
I know, said Bell. I knowed what you'd say before you said it.
Moss pulled into Eagle Pass at 2:15 in the morning. He'd slept a good part of the way in the back of the cab, and he only woke when they slowed coming off the highway and down Main Street. He watched the pale white globes of the street lamps pass along the upper rim of the window. Then he sat up.
You going across the river?
The driver said.
No, just take me downtown.
You are downtown.
Moss leaned forward with his elbows on the back of the seat.
What's that right there?
That's the Maverick County Courthouse.
No, right there where the sign is.
That's the Hotel Eagle.
Drop me there.
He paid the driver the $50 they'd agreed on, and picked up his bags off the curb, and walked up the steps to the porch and went in. The clerk was standing at the desk as if he'd been expecting him. He paid and put the key in his pocket and climbed the stairs and walked down the old hotel corridor. Dead quiet. No lights in the transoms. He found the room and put the key in the door and opened it, and went in and shut the door behind him. Light from the street lamps coming through the lace curtains at the window. He set the bags on the bed and went back to the door and switched on the overhead light. Old-fashioned push-button switch plate. Oak furniture from the turn of the century, brown walls, same chenille bedspread. He sat on the bed, thinking things over. He got up and looked out the window at the parking lot, and he went into the bathroom and got a glass of water and came back and sat on the bed again. He took a sip and set the water on the glass top of the wooden bedside table.
There is no goddamn way, he said.
He undid the brass latch and the buckles on the case and began to take the packets of money out and to stack them on the bed. When the case was empty, he checked it for a false bottom, and he checked the back and the sides, and then he set it aside and began to go through the stacks of bills, riffling each of the packets and stacking them back in the case. He'd packed it about a third full before he found the sending unit. The middle of the packet had been filled in with dollar bills, with the centers cut out, and the transponder unit, nested there, was about the size of a Zippo lighter. He slid back the tape and took it out and weighed it in his hand. Then he put it in the drawer and got up and took the cut-out dollar bills and the bank tape to the bathroom and flushed them down the toilet and came back. He folded the loose hundreds and put them in his pocket, and then packed the rest of the banknotes into the case again and set the case in the chair and sat there looking at it. He thought about a lot of things, but the thing that stayed with him was that at some point he was going to have to quit running on luck. He got the shotgun out of the bag and laid it on the bed and turned on the bedside lamp. He went to the door and turned off the overhead light and came back and stretched out on the bed and stared at the ceiling. He knew what was coming. He just didn't know when. He got up and went into the bathroom and pulled the chain on the light over the sink and looked at himself in the mirror. He took a washcloth from the glass towel bar and turned on the hot water and wet the cloth and wrung it out and wiped his face and the back of his neck. He took a leak and then switched off the light and went back and sat on the bed. It had already occurred to him that he would probably never be safe again in his life, and he wondered if that was something that you got used to. And if you did... He emptied out the bag and put the shotgun in and zipped it shut and took it, together with the satchel, down to the desk. The Mexican who'd checked him in was gone, and in his place was another clerk, thin and gray. A thin white shirt and a black bow tie. He was smoking a cigarette and reading Ring magazine, and he looked up at Moss with no great enthusiasm, squinting in the smoke.
"Yes, sir," he said.
"Did you just come on?"
"Yes, sir. Be here till 10 in the morning."
Moss laid a $100 bill on the counter. The clerk put down the magazine.
"I ain't asking you to do nothing illegal," Moss said.
"I'm just waiting to hear your description of that," the clerk said.
"There's somebody looking for me. All I'm asking you to do is to call me if anybody checks in. By anybody, I mean any swinging dick. Can you do that?"
The night clerk took the cigarette out of his mouth and held it over a small glass ashtray and tipped the ash from the end of it with his little finger and looked at Moss.
"Yes, sir," he said. "I can do that."
Moss nodded and went back upstairs. The phone never rang. Something woke him. He sat up and looked at the clock on the table. 4:37. He swung his legs over the side of the bed and reached and got his boots and pulled them on and sat listening. He went over and stood with his ear to the door and shotgun in one hand. He went in the bathroom and pulled back the plastic shower curtain where it hung on rings over the tub and turned on the tap and pulled the plunger to start the shower. Then he pulled the curtain back around the tub and went out and closed the bathroom door behind him. He stood at the door listening again. He dragged out the nylon bag from where he'd pushed it under the bed and set it in the chair in the corner. He went over and switched on the light at the bedside table and stood there trying to think. He realized that the phone might ring, and he took the receiver from the cradle and laid it on the table. He pulled back the covers and rumpled the pillows on the bed. He looked at the clock. 4:43. He looked at the phone lying there on the table. He picked it up and pulled the cord out of it and put it back in the cradle. Then he went over and stood at the door, his thumb on the hammer of the shotgun. He dropped to his stomach and put his ear to the space under the door. A cool wind, as if a door had opened somewhere. "What have you done? What have you failed to do?" He went to the far side of the bed and dropped down and pushed himself underneath it and lay there on his stomach with the shotgun pointed at the door. Just space enough beneath the wooden slats. Heart pumping against the dusty carpet. He waited. Two columns of dark intersected the bar of light beneath the door and stood there. The next thing he heard was the key in the lock, very softly. Then the door opened. He could see out into the hallway. There was no one there. He waited. He tried not even to blink, but he did. Then there was an expensive pair of ostrich-skinned boots standing in the doorway, pressed jeans. The man stood there. Then he came in. Then he crossed slowly to the bathroom. At that moment, Moss realized that he was not going to open the bathroom door. He was going to turn around. And when he did, it would be too late. Too late to make any more mistakes or to do anything at all, and that he was going to die. "Do it," he said. "Just do it." "Don't turn around," he said. "You turn around and I'll blow you to hell." The man didn't move. Moss was walking forward on his elbows, holding the shotgun. He could see no higher than the man's waist, and he didn't know what kind of gun he was carrying. "Drop the gun," he said. "Do it now." A shotgun clattered to the floor. Moss pulled himself up. "Get your hands up," he said. "Step back from the door." He took two steps back and stood, his hands at shoulder level. Moss came around the end of the bed. The man was no more than 10 feet away. The whole room was pulsing slowly. There was an odd smell in the air, like some foreign cologne, a medicinal edge to it. Everything humming. Moss held the shotgun at his waist with the hammer cocked. There was nothing that could happen that would have surprised him. He felt as if he weighed nothing. He felt as if he were floating. The man didn't even look at him. He seemed oddly untroubled, as if this were all part of his day. Back up. Some more. He did. Moss picked up the man's shotgun and threw it onto the bed. He switched on the overhead light and shut the door. Look over here, he said. The man turned his head and gazed at Moss. Blue eyes, serene, dark hair. Something about him faintly exotic, beyond Moss's experience. What do you want? He didn't answer. Moss crossed the room and took hold of the footpost of the bed and swung the bed sideways with one hand. The document case stood there in the dust. He picked it up. The man didn't even seem to notice. His thoughts seemed elsewhere. He took the nylon bag from the chair and slung it over his shoulder, and he got the shotgun with its huge can-like silencer off the bed and put it under his arm and picked up the case again. Let's go, he said. The man lowered his hands and walked out into the hallway. The small box that held the transponder receiver was standing in the floor just outside the door. Moss left it there. He had a feeling he'd already taken more chances than he had coming. He backed down the hallway with his shotgun trained on the man's belt, holding it in one hand like a pistol. He started to tell him to put his hands back up, but something told him that it didn't really make any difference where the man's hands were. The bedroom door was still open, the shower still running. You show your face at the head of these stairs, and I'll shoot you. The man didn't answer. He could have been a mute for all that Moss knew. Right there, Moss said. Don't you take another step. He stopped. Moss backed to the stairs and took one last look at him standing there in the dull yellow light from the wall sconce. And then he turned and doubled down the stairwell, taking the steps two at a time. He didn't know where he was going. He hadn't thought that far ahead. In the lobby, the night clerk's feet were sticking out from behind the desk. Moss didn't stop. He pushed out through the front door and down the steps. By the time he'd crossed the street, Chigurh was already on the balcony of the hotel above him. Moss felt something tug at the bag on his shoulder. The pistol shot was just a muffled pop, flat and small in the dark quiet of the town. He turned in time to see the muzzle flash of the second shot, faint but visible under the pink glow of the 15-foot-high neon hotel sign. He didn't feel anything. The bullet snapped at his shirt, and blood started running down his upper arm, and he was already at a dead run. With the next shot, he felt a stinging pain in his side. He fell down and got up again, leaving Chigurh's shotgun lying in the street. Damn, he said. What a shot. He loped wincing down the sidewalk past the Aztec Theater. As he passed the little round ticket kiosk, all the glass fell out of it. He never even heard that shot. He spun with the shotgun and thumbed back the hammer and fired. The buckshot rattled off the second-story balustrade and took the glass out of some of the windows. When he turned again, a car coming down Main Street picked him up in the lights and slowed and then speeded up again. He turned up Adams Street, and the car skidded sideways through the intersection in a cloud of rubber smoke and stopped. The engine had died, and the driver was trying to start it. Moss turned with his back to the brick wall of the building. Two men had come from the car and were crossing the street on foot at a run. One of them opened fire with a small-caliber machine gun, and he fired at them twice with the shotgun and then loped on with the warm blood seeping into his crotch. In the street, he heard the car start up again. By the time he got to Grand Street, a pandemonium of gunfire had broken out behind him. He didn't think he could run anymore.
He saw himself limping along in a store window across the street, holding his elbow to his side, the bag slung over his shoulder, and carrying the shotgun and the leather document case, dark in the glass and wholly unaccountable. When he looked again, he was sitting on the sidewalk.
"Get up, you son of a bitch," he said. "Don't you sit there and die. You get the hell up."
He crossed Ryan Street with blood sloshing in his boots. He pulled the bag around and unzipped it and shoved the shotgun in and zipped it shut again. He stood, tottering. Then he crossed to the bridge. He was cold and shivering, and he thought he was going to vomit. There was a change window and a turnstile on the American side of the bridge, and he put a dime in the slot and pushed through and staggered out onto the span and eyed the narrow walk ahead of him, just breaking first light, dull and gray above the floodplain along the east shore of the river, God's own distance to the far side. Halfway, he met a party returning, four of them, young boys, maybe 18, partly drunk. He set the case on the sidewalk and took a pack of the hundreds from his pocket. The money was slick with blood. He wiped it on his trouser leg and peeled off five of the bills and put the rest in his back pocket.
"Excuse me," he said, leaning against the chain-link fence, his bloody footprints on the walk behind him like clues in an arcade. "Excuse me."
They were stepping off the curb into the roadway to go around him.
"Excuse me, I wondered if you all would sell me a coat."
They didn't stop till they were past him. Then one of them turned.
"What do you give?" he said.
"That man behind you, the one in the long coat."
The one in the long coat stopped with the others.
"How much?"
"I'll give you $500.
"Bullshit. Come on, Brian.
"Let's go, Brian. He's drunk."
Brian looked at them, and he looked at Moss.
"Let's see the money," he said.
"It's right here."
"Let me see it."
"Let me hold the coat."
"Let's go, Brian."
"You take this 100, and let me hold the coat. Then I'll give you the rest."
"All right."
He slipped out of the coat and handed it over, and Moss handed him the bill.
"What's this on it?"
"Blood."
"Blood?"
"Blood."
He stood holding the bill in one hand. He looked at the blood on his fingers.
"What happened to you?"
"I've been shot." "Let's go, Brian. God damn."
"Let me have the money."
Moss handed him the bills and unshouldered the zipper bag to the sidewalk and struggled into the coat. The boy folded the bills and put them in his pocket and stepped away. He joined the others and they went on. Then they stopped. They were talking together and looking back at him. He got the coat buttoned and put his money in the inside pocket and shouldered the bag and picked up the leather case.
"You all need to keep walking," he said. "I won't tell you twice."
They turned and went on. There were only three of them. He shoved at his eyes with the heel of his hand. He tried to see where the fourth one had gone. Then he realized that there was no fourth one.
"That's all right," he said. "Just keep putting one foot in front of the other."
When he reached the place where the river actually passed beneath the bridge, he stopped and stood looking down at it. The Mexican gate shack was just ahead. He looked back down the bridge, but the three were gone. A grainy light to the east, over the low black hills beyond the town. The water moved beneath him, slow and dark. A dog somewhere. Silence. Nothing. There was a stand of tall carrizo cane, growing along the American side of the river below him, and he set the zipper bag down and took hold of the case by the handles and swung it behind him and then heaved it over the rail and out into space.
White-hot pain.
He held his side and watched the bag turn slowly in the diminishing light from the bridge lamps and drop soundlessly into the cane and vanish. Then he slid to the pavement and sat there in the puddling blood, his face against the wire.
"Get up," he said.
Damn you. Get up.
When he reached the gatehouse, there was no one there. He pushed through and into the town of Piedras Negras, state of Coahuila. He made his way up the street to a small park or zocalo on the left where the grackles in the eucalyptus trees were waking and calling. The trees were painted white to the height of a wainscot, and from a distance the park seemed set with white posts arrayed at random. In the center, a wrought-iron gazebo or bandstand. He collapsed on one of the iron benches with the bag on the bench beside him and leaned forward, holding himself. Globes of orange light hung from the lampstands, the world receding. Across from the park was a church. It seemed far away. The grackles creaked and swayed in the branches overhead, and day was coming. He put out one hand on the bench beside him, nausea.
Don't lie down.
No sun, just the gray light breaking, the streets wet, the shops closed, iron shutters. An old man was coming along, pushing a broom. He paused. Then he moved on.
Señor, Ma said.
Bueno,
the old man said.
You speak English?
He studied Moss, holding the broom handle in both hands. He shrugged his shoulders.
I need a doctor.
The old man waited for more. Moss pushed himself up. The bench was bloody.
I've been shot, he said.
The old man looked him over. He clucked his tongue. He looked away toward the dawn, the trees and buildings taking shape. He looked at Moss and gestured with his chin.
Puede andar, he said.
What?
Puede caminar.
He made walking motions with his fingers, his hand hanging loosely at the wrist. Moss nodded. A wave of blackness came over him. He waited till it passed.
¿Tiene dinero?
The sweeper rubbed his thumb and fingers together.
Sí,
Moss said.
Sí.
He rose and stood swaying. He took the packet of blood-soaked bills from the overcoat pocket and separated a $100 note and handed it to the old man. The old man took it with great reverence. He looked at Moss, and then he stood the broom against the bench. When Shiger came down the steps and out the front door of the hotel, he had a towel wrapped around his upper right leg and tied with sections of window blind cord. The towel was already wet through with blood. He was carrying a small bag in one hand and a pistol in the other. The Cadillac was crossways in the intersection, and there was gunfire in the street. He stepped back into the doorway of the barber shop. The clatter of automatic rifle fire and the deep, heavy slam of a shotgun rattling off the facades of the buildings. The men in the street were dressed in raincoats and tennis shoes. They didn't look like anybody you would expect to meet in this part of the country. He limped back up the steps to the porch and laid the pistol over the balustrade and opened fire on them. By the time they'd figured out where the fire was coming from, he'd killed one and wounded another. The wounded man got behind the car and opened up on the hotel. Shiger stood with his back to the brick wall and fitted a fresh clip into the pistol. The rounds were taking out the glass in the doors and splintering up the sash work. The foyer light went out. It was still dark enough in the street that you could see the muzzle flashes. There was a break in the firing, and Shiger turned and pushed his way through into the hotel lobby, the bits of glass crackling under his boots. He went gimping down the hallway and down the steps at the rear of the hotel and out into the parking lot. He crossed the street and went up Jefferson, keeping to the north wall of the buildings, trying to hurry and swinging the bound leg out at his side. All of this was one block from the Maverick County Courthouse, and he figured he had minutes at best before fresh parties began to arrive. When he got to the corner, there was only one man standing in the street. He was at the rear of the car, and the car was badly shot up, all the glass gone or shot white. There was at least one body inside. The man was watching the hotel, and Shiger leveled the pistol and shot him twice, and he fell down in the street. Shiger stepped back behind the corner of the building and stood with the pistol upright at his shoulder,
waiting. A rich tang of gunpowder on the cool morning air, like the smell of fireworks. No sound anywhere. When he limped out into the street, one of the men he'd shot from the hotel porch was crawling toward the curb. Sugar watched him. Then he shot him in the back. The other one was lying by the front fender of the car. He'd been shot through the head, and the dark blood was pooled all about him. His weapon was lying there, but Sugar paid it no mind. He walked to the rear of the car and jostled the man there with his boot, and then bent and picked up the machine gun he'd been firing. It was a short-barreled Uzi with a 25-round clip. Sugar rifled the dead man's raincoat pockets and came up with three more clips, one of them full. He put them in the pocket of his jacket and stuck the pistol down in the front of his belt and checked the rounds in the clip that was in the Uzi. Then he slung the piece over his shoulder and hobbled back to the curb. The man he'd shot in the back was lying there, watching him. Sugar looked up the street toward the hotel and the courthouse, the tall palm trees. He looked at the man. The man was lying in a spreading pool of blood.
"Help me," he said.
Sugar took the pistol from his waist. He looked into the man's eyes. The man looked away.
"Look at me," Sugar said.
The man looked and looked away again.
"Do you speak English?"
"Yes."
"Don't look away. I want you to look at me."
He looked at Sugar. He looked at the new day paling all about. Sugar shot him through the forehead and then stood watching him, watching the capillaries break up in his eyes, the light receding, watching his own image degrade in that squandered world. He shoved the pistol in his belt and looked back up the street once more. Then he picked up the bag and slung the Uzi over his shoulder and crossed the street and went limping on toward the hotel parking lot, where he'd left his vehicle. Part 5.
"We come here from Georgia. Our family did. Horse and wagon. I pretty much know that for a fact. I know there's lots of things in a family history that just plain ain't so, any family. The stories get passed on and the truth gets passed over, as the saying goes. Which I reckon some would take as meaning that the truth can't compete. But I don't believe that. I think that when the lies are all told and forgot, the truth will be there yet. It don't move about from place to place, and it don't change from time to time. You can't corrupt it any more than you can salt salt. You can't corrupt it because that's what it is. It's the thing you're talking about. I've heard it compared to the rock, maybe in the Bible, and I wouldn't disagree with that. But it'll be here even when the rock is gone. I'm sure these people would disagree with that, quite a few, in fact. But I never could find out what any of them did believe. You always tried to be available for your social events, and I would always go to things like cemetery cleanings, of course. That was all right. The women would fix dinner on the ground, and of course it was a way of campaigning, but you were doing something for folks that couldn't do it for themselves. Well, you could be cynical about it, I reckon, and say that you just didn't want them coming around at night. But I think it goes deeper than that. It is community, and it is respect, of course. But the dead have more claims on you than what you might want to admit, or even what you might know about. And them claims can be very strong indeed. Very strong indeed. You get the feeling they just don't want to turn loose. So any little thing helps in that respect. What I was saying the other day about the papers. Here last week, they found this couple out in California. They would rent out rooms to old people and then kill them and bury them in the yard and cash their social security checks. They torture them first. I don't know why. Maybe their television was broke. Now, here's what the papers had to say about that. I quote from the papers. Said, "Neighbors were alerted when a man run from the premises wearing only a dog collar." You can't make up such a thing as that. I dare you to even try. But that's what it took, you'll notice. All that hollering and digging in the yard didn't bring it. That's all right. I laughed myself when I read it. There ain't a whole lot else you can do.
It was almost a 3-hour drive to Odessa, and dark when